Welcome to a brand new edition of Problematic Women. I'm Virginia Allen.
And I'm Kristen Eichhammer.
And joining us back in studio with us today is our good friend, Brenda Hefera, who serves as a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Brenda, thanks for being here.
Always happy to be here.
So fun to have you back. So Tuesday was, of course, Super Tuesday. Thursday night is State of the Union. It's a big week across the country. There were 15 states that voted on Super Tuesday, and we saw that former President Donald Trump on the Republican side won every state except for Vermont. Nikki Haley won Vermont. But then Wednesday morning, Nikki Haley announced that she's dropping out of the race. So what we're looking at is a classic lineup between what we had exactly last time. And I say classic, like, oh, it's so old.
It's become classic.
It feels classic now. But between President Biden and former President Donald Trump, there'll be all indications, unless something crazy happens, they will be facing off in November.
Yeah,
here
I mean,
we go.
We have a long way ahead of us. We're not even at the convention yet, and it feels like it's been 10 years. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but one
it's
thing
like
is
the
for
Titanic
certain.
Titanic meme. It's been 84 years.
Oh, jeez, dude. Why are we bringing the Titanic up, Virginia?
Not that this is a sinking ship at all. No, we stay positive here.
Oh, but man, it is going to be a long general election.
It is.
Which is kind of unique. So I don't know what's going to happen with that, but now it's pretty clear that we have the two candidates that we will have. And while there are always surprises, you never know.
Yeah. No, you never know. And I think that is the fun part, right, about elections is there can always be wild surprises. And for folks that work in politics, the hope is often like, all right, let's get some surprises. Let's keep it interesting, right?
And we've got some fun stuff going on the Hill, too. McConnell stepped down, or not stepped down, but he's planning to.
As leader.
We've got a lot of things to shake up. Which is good for Washington, because look at the economy right now. It's trash.
We need the shakeup. All right. Well, we have a full show planned today. Kristen, what do we have queued up?
Up on today's Problematic Women, we chat feminism and how things have changed since the early days of it. And later, VJ Day and the kiss photo. Controversy over that, surprisingly, we break it down. And finally, we provide you with an update on some of the scarier details of what happened in early October and some of the findings that, surprise, surprise, UN is starting to talk about. And as always, we'll be crowning our Problematic Women of the Week.
Each week on Problematic Women, we sort through the news to find those stories that are of particular interest to conservative-leaning or problematic women, those whose views and opinions are often excluded by those on the so-called feminist left.
If you are a problematic woman or just someone who supports strong, independent women, please consider supporting us by leaving a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and encouraging others to subscribe. It really does make a difference.
All right, let's get to it. We are returning to our roots here on Problematic Women today and talking about feminism. So this is so fun. And Brenda, you recently wrote a fantastic piece talking about feminism and work, which I thought was such a brilliant point that has been talked about, but just the way you framed it was incredibly enlightening. What I loved is that you did this piece and you gave voice to what I think many people have felt and really voiced to what I would say is the foundation in many ways of the feminist movement, which is this passion and desire for opportunity, for purpose, and that wrestle that I think women can be in, that anyone is in, because we all want purpose, we all want to be seen, we all want to feel like we're achieving. And so out of that, I think you saw this birthing of the feminist movement. And of course, it's gone down all sorts of roads that the founders of the feminist movement never intended. You quote Betty Friedan in your article, who, of course, is the author of The Feminist Mystique. So in your piece, you quote The Feminine Mystique written by Betty Friedan, and you argue that the book is really, in many ways, about work. And Brenda, you look at the work of Betty Friedan, and you say that she holds up this picture of those who are satisfied as those who sought to fulfill an ambition of their own, long buried or brand new, to work at top capacity, to have a sense of achievement. And when I read that, I was like, ooh, that is good, because we all resonate with that. I want to work at capacity. I want to be stretched, right? Mm-hmm. I want to see what my limits are. And at the end of the day, I want to have achievement for having reached those limits. Is the raw original purpose of the feminist movement that desire to fulfill ambition, to work, to gain a sense of achievement, in your opinion?
Well, thank you, Virginia. I think that's a great question. So first wave feminism is really about women achieving the vote, about mm-hmm. women being able to be educated, and the elimination of coverture marriage. Second wave feminism, which is when Betty Friedan is writing, I think many of those questions are about work. And the reason I think Betty Friedan is a good example is that there's this complicated relationship between feminism and the sexual revolution. Mm. And now we sort of look back and group them all in together very often and lose kind of some of the nuance of that relationship. So Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique is a good example because that's prior to this messy entanglement with the sexual revolution. So we can kind of see what feminism was about, second wave feminism was about before that. And The Feminine Mystique is about work. Mm. I mean, it's not a philosophical text. Betty Friedan is a complicated figure, and she says some things that denigrate motherhood and denigrate work within the home. But if you take a broad sense of what The Feminine Mystique is about, rather than trying to parse it out as a philosophical text, you get this sense that there's been these shifts and suburban women have been left in the home because there was the shift of the Industrial Revolution where men went out to work and women stayed home. And that was new. It's a deviation from the agrarian household where everyone was working on the farm together. And there's this sense of a lack of purpose. There's a sense of boredom. There's a sense of loneliness that Betty Friedan captures of these women. Technologies have freed them from protracted housework, which is great. Things like the vacuum cleaner, the washing machine, right? But then they feel like they don't have as much to do, that they have more time on their hands. The television is invented. There's this age of consumerism. And then they're having fewer children. And so when their children are in school, they're left at home kind of like, well, I could do more, mm-hmm. right? Could I do more with my time? And against that backdrop is also the hollowing out of philanthropic associations. So for much of American history, especially early American history, women took a lead in those volunteer programs and philanthropic associations. And what starts to happen about 1920, according to Marvin Alasky, is that work gets replaced. Volunteers get replaced with credentialed social workers. Mm. So the government is starting to displace volunteers. So a lot of those volunteers were, of course, women. And these sorts of conditions give rise to the movement of second wave feminism.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. So I love that picture that you paint that I think, you know, we see out and play out in shows like Leave It to Beaver and things. But it's like, okay, this makes so much sense. All of a sudden, women have been handed time with things like washing machines and modern ovens and all of these things. And it's like, okay, there's this restlessness that ensues of, okay, well, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The kids are still in school and everything is set in the house. And what do I do now? And from that, how do we see then these further shifts within the feminist movement to where it almost moves from being about pursuing work? Because if I were to ask anyone on the street, what's the feminist movement about? I don't think anyone would say it's about work. It's about finding purpose in your work. Like at the end of the day, you know, most people, they would bring up, especially on the left, you know, they're going to bring up things like abortion. They're going to bring up, you know, if you go back, of course, there's beautiful things of the right to vote and having those rights and equal opportunities. Most people don't think about work. So when did the thinking begin to shift?
Right. I would give two examples. One is the alliance that feminists forged with sexual revolutionaries when it came to abortion. Mm. So abortion is not in the Feminine Mystique. It's not an issue. And then what happens is a man named Larry Ladder, whose work was cited several times in Roe v. Wade, worked on Betty Friedan for quite some time to get that added to the platform for the National Organization for Women. And that meeting is very complicated. It was sort of rammed through in the meeting. It's mysterious as to how the votes were counted because not everyone voted on adding abortion to the platform. So it's very strange. Susan Allen Browder wrote a book called Subverted, and she was there and recounts
this
story.
We've talked about the book on the show. It's fantastic.
It is. It's
read the book.
Fascinating. Yes. And so then abortion gets added to the platform, which these women were surprised that wasn't a second wave feminist issue. So that's one turn. So then it gets entangled with the sexual revolution. And then the second turn, I would say, is Betty Friedan, I think, gives a good descriptive account of what's going on in second wave feminism in the 50s and 60s to middle class American women. And people follow her to the solutions she offers because her description is so good and her solutions are not very good. So she's really grounding her work in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is becoming popular at the time. And it's a very atheistic, psychological understanding of the human person, of self-actualization rather than the human person. So it's this idea of you can create your own morality, that just use your talents and whatever direction that goes. So it's not grounded in objective views. Mm-hmm. It's not grounded in morality. It's not grounded in understanding of Christian vocation. And that's a really bad move. And there's the whole psychological movement of the 50s and 60s is something that we're still living in today. We live in a very psychological world. So that's a very big problem. And then one last example is Kate Millett comes on the scene, and Kate Millett has a fight with Betty Friedan. And Kate Millett is a radical Marxist and sexual revolutionary to the point that she thinks children should be sexualized. Mm-hmm. And there's this fight within the National Organization of Women of if they're going to go in the Betty Friedan direction or the Kate Millett direction. And Kate Millett wins out. And so the sexual revolutionary ideas, the Kate Millets, the Simone de Beauvoir, they're the ones who actually win out in the movement and take over.
And we've seen the fruit of that play out then in the years after.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay, so then fast forward to where we are today, and I think with individuals like yourself, we've seen this this effort, I think, on behalf of conservatives to, let's remember what the roots are here. Let's go back to the foundation, and let's remind folks of the good parts of the feminist movement and some of those original intentions. And we've seen this sort of new movement arise that you mentioned in your article. And there's actually a whole new website that has come with that that's essentially a news outlet that's sort of promoting the ideas of classic or first wave, somewhat into second wave feminism. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Right. So there's this new project. It's called Fair Disputations is the website. It's part of the Wollstone Craft Project at the Abigail Adams Institute. And these are individuals. They don't agree on everything, of course. And some of them may not even identify as traditional conservatives, but they all agree on, and I'm going to quote here, a vision of female and male as embodied expressions of human personhood, and affirm that men and women are equal in their dignity and their capacity for human excellence, yet distinct in many significant ways, particularly when it comes to sex, pregnancy, childbirth, and care for children. Mm. So it's basically the sexes are equal in dignity, but there are biological differences right, that matter. And so folks like Erica Bakayoki, who's at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Abigail Favaliti, who's at Notre Dame, and Mary Harrington, who's at Unheard, are writing for them. There are some of these women. And they publish both original pieces and then compile other works across the publications and then send out a newsletter, for example, if you should read this. And so it's a really, I think, an interesting project. And I think it's a return to some of these questions and a return to trying to parse out the relationship between feminism and the sexual revolution. I think there's some concern that we're getting over-reactionary in our dialogue about feminism, especially amongst our own conservatives, about feminism is the source of all evil and it's the root of all these problems. And that's not quite right, of course. And so it's looking back at these things and trying, I think, to look at them in context as well. For example, something I talk about is Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique sold a million copies its first year. Mm-hmm. That's a blockbuster. Yeah. That's huge. I think in 2015, there's about 10 books that sold that many.
Wow.
Right. And the population was, of course, much larger
yeah.
in that year. And Betty Friedan's a nobody. Mm-hmm. She's not a celebrity that everyone's anticipating, oh, they're coming out with this memoir.
She comes out of nowhere. She doesn't have social media to make reels about her book.
So maybe we should consider, hey, there's something to this.
Yeah.
If a million people were reading this, let's look with a view of curiosity, of mm-hmm. trying to understand what was going on here.
And it obviously resonated with people. Women were reading it and saying, I can identify. I'm feeling heard and seen in reading this book.
Well, and even as I listen to this, this is not an issue I'm necessarily super familiar with, hence the crickets on my side. But I think you're totally right. There's this interest and appetite to understand what feminism really is. And that first and second wave are drastically different given. And if you think about it, too, when we study history and all of that, I feel like we just gloss over. It's usually like you spend most of your first semester on like the Revolutionary War. And then it's like World War One, World War Two, and then everything else that happened within like the last 2 weeks of school. So we don't even really growing up have conversations about this. So
yeah.
just having voices on both sides, they, you know, that book, obviously in 2015, there was interest, but there's still so much more discussion to have. So thank you for opening that up and even more and having that conversation.
I mean, these are questions we're still struggling with
yeah.
today. You know, I don't think feminism came up with good answers. I think mm-hmm. actually the better answers are found in theology and philosophy, of an understanding of a human person, human nature, what really fulfills human beings. And Betty Friedan falls completely short of that because she turns to the psychologists, right, mm-hmm. which are pretty shallow thinkers.
And man-made.
Yeah, and man-made. And so, but today those questions about, you know, what is the place of work? What is the dignity of work for both men and women?
Mm-hmm.
What is its relationship to the family? And those are difficult and interesting questions
yeah.
that we should still engage with.
Well, and I think we're created to ask those questions,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, those are very biblical questions. You look back at Genesis, and what was, you know, the first command that God gave Adam and Eve? It was working and tilling the garden and being fruitful and multiplying. It's this idea of you're putting labor in, and then you're also creating more hands to be a part of working what you've been given. And it's such a foundational part of who we are as people, that we're all created for something larger than ourselves and for something that looks like a contribution to that which is bigger than us, to the outside world.
Right. In the Christian understanding, vocation and work is with a view towards service to God
mm-hmm.
or your fellow human beings, or to inculcating virtue in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a direction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a telos for those abilities and talents, and you are called to use them, not bury them.
So good. Healthy. Well, we are going to leave a link in today's show notes for Brenda's full piece on this if you want to dive a little deeper. I was sitting on my couch last night with a cup of tea reading it, and it was great. Absolutely lovely. But stay tuned, because in a moment, we're going to talk a little bit about another hot button issue that's similar, touching on World War II
yeah,
a little
bit. Yeah, just craziness.
But in the meantime, I want to tell you all about a really great resource. The Network of Enlightened Women sees the challenges that conservative women are up against on their college campuses. From liberal professors to finding friends on campuses, it can be a really lonely place to be a conservative woman. And so that is what inspired News President Karen Lipps to write You're Not Alone, the Conservative Women's Guide to College. Readers can get to know more than 20 college students and alumni as they share their stories of real challenges on college campuses and offer some practical advice. With these stories, Lipps identifies problems on campuses and provides practical tips on how conservative young women can thrive in this environment. This college guide covers the many struggles and real-life situations that college women will face, whether they're a freshman or a senior. Empowering these women will help them, will help you become more effective to advocate for conservative ideas during your time at college. You're Not Alone, The Conservative Women's Guide to College is available right now for purchase on Amazon. You can buy a copy today for yourself, maybe a friend, daughter, sister, someone who's facing that challenge of living life on a very secular college campus, far left college campus, as a conservative woman. To learn more, you can visit the Network of Enlightened Women website. Their website is enlightenedwomen.org. Again, that's enlightenedwomen.org. And you can also find the book on Amazon.
All right, so a new agency, not really new, I guess they've been in the news quite a bit during this administration, but they haven't made news a lot in the last few months. So that's why I thought this was so interesting. But the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Dennis McDonough, reversed a controversial department memo that aimed to ban an iconic photo from VA facilities. This photo in question, VJ Day in Times Square, was taken on August 14th, 1945, also known as VJ Day. That is the day that Japan surrendered to the U.S., ending the deadliest war in all of our history, World War II.
Day.
Yeah, huge day. It's considered an iconic photo, though, and was even featured on Time Magazine's front cover. Like, it was a huge photo.
Well, and it's very, it's a classic poster, I feel like, I see, like, college dorm rooms.
Everyone has seen this.
Yeah, I mean, Night at the Museum reenacted it at one point or something. Or not reenacted it, they had it. But it's also referred to as the kiss for those of you who maybe are putting the dots together now. In this photo, you will see people spilling into New York City streets from restaurants, bars, and movies celebrating the end of the war and the news that, I mean, it just had come. So everyone's celebrating. People are kind of like, thank God, you know, this disaster is over. And so this iconic photo embraces that. You can see two individuals, you know, kissing. It's a beautiful moment. It's people describe it that were there that day as it was a thank God moment. It wasn't supposed to be gross. It wasn't supposed to be sexualized. It was thank God we can move back to life is normal, or kind of normal at that point. We're going to pick up the pieces and start to rebuild. Now, the reasoning for this memo wasn't exactly what I expected when I kind of did some digging. VA Undersecretary Rima Nelson explained that she wanted the photo removed from all VA health facilities because it depicts a non-consensual act and is inconsistent with the department's sexual harassment policy. And then she goes on to explain that the photo should be removed to foster a more trauma informed environment that promotes the psychological safety of our employees and the veterans we serve. Secretary McDonough tweeted within hours of this memo's release, and then it went viral because it's a little crazy. The memo's release, and she tweeted, "Let me be clear, this image is not banned from VA facilities." Very interesting, all the story all around. It kind of shows you where we're at in society of an iconic, beautiful photo that is meant to only inspire goodness and celebrate a beautiful moment in our history is becoming controversial. What are your thoughts? Like, should the VA be prioritizing memos like this and in policies like this?
There's an expression that if you have a hammer, everything is a nail. And this is obviously coming from someone who has these lens on of, all right, let me go out and look for, you know, is everything fitting in my box? Okay, here's something that seems like sort of, I don't even want to call it sexual because it's not, but an act of affection. And, you know, was that consensual fully? Did he ask before? We don't know, so we should take it down. It's just with these very specific glasses. And when you do that, then you eliminate seeing the beauty of what the moment really was, Kristen, like you so wonderfully expressed, that it was a moment of celebration and freedom and this desire of finally, praise God, we're alive. For the two people in the photo, we're alive and we can get back to family. We can get back to friends. We can get back to life. Maybe it will forever be changed, but some resemblance of normal apart from war. And that is easily missed when you have a hammer and you're searching for things to pound out.
Right. I think many people's reaction is, don't we have better things to worry about? I mean, especially
it's the VA. It has the worst reputation.
Your job is to take care of our veterans. What are you doing?
And I've heard, you know, their healthcare system is a mess. There are other things that they could be doing. And the military in general, we've had a recruitment crisis the past couple of years. I think in 2020, only 25% of men ages 17 to 24 qualified for the military. Mm-hmm. Like, there are bigger problems that we should be focusing on than this kind of presentism where we're going to read back from today and say this was wrong. And no one at the time thought it was wrong. It became an iconic photo for a reason. Mm-hmm.
1954.
Well, and I believe that they were successful in tracking down the woman. I don't know if they ever were able to track down the man. I think that was what I heard from that story. But in a fun piece of family history, my grandmother, who has since passed but was out there, or says she was out there that day, and she was very cute when you would ask her about it. So she was engaged to my grandfather at the time, who was serving in World War II, and she's so cute because she's like, oh yeah, we were all out there kissing boys. I was like, Nana, you were engaged. She's like, yeah, it wasn't a big deal.
Because it was celebrating. They weren't going to get nude.
Now, in fairness, my grandmother had a tendency to embellish stories a little bit. So,
oh, it wasn't embellished. I believe it.
Totally know how many boys she kissed, but according to her, she kissed many boys that day.
It's New York, man. Anything happens there nowadays. But last thought, just on the VA side of things, I actually totally forgot to tell you this yesterday when we were talking about this story. I volunteered at the Hines VA Hospital in Illinois.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I do actually, they had photos from all over across history. So to your point, this is the Assistant Undersecretary for Health for Operation. Bigger fish to fry. Is she like going to be navigating every hall, which these facilities are huge? Like, is that what we're going to be putting?
Really?
When veterans are waiting months and months and months and months and years sometimes to receive attention. So... yeah, not only is that horrible, but like it's a moment where even your grandmother is like, this was beautiful. This was fun. And your grandpa clearly didn't care. They got married.
he learned in their married life to say yes, dear.
What a smart man.
They were adorable.
Supportive.
Love them. All right. Well, that was a good conversation. I'm glad we got to laugh a little bit. We're moving into a heavier conversation now. I feel like I have to give warning. And I do want to take a minute to actually give a formal disclaimer that we're going to be talking about some of the atrocities carried out against the people of Israel on October 7th in this segment following a new report out of the United Nations. So I'm going to read some of the content that came out of this new report from the United Nations, and it is pretty disturbing. So go ahead and skip forward maybe 5 or 10 minutes if you're not comfortable hearing some of this. But what the United Nations did is they launched an investigation earlier this year into the sexual violence carried out by Hamas on October 7th. After the attack on Israel, we began hearing these stories of really disturbing reports of sexual violence that have been carried out in Israel. So the UN they took time to look into these claims, to really investigate what was happening, and they just released the findings this week of their initial investigation into what sexual violence was carried out specifically against women on October 7th. So UN Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence in Conflict, Pramila Patton, she led the team to Israel and the West Bank for about a two-week trip that they spent over there. And during those 2 weeks, Patton and her team conducted 33 meetings with Israeli national institutions. They reviewed over 5,000 photos and 50 hours of footage from the attack on October 7th. As someone that has seen 45 minutes of footage, I can't imagine reviewing 50 hours. It's just so intense. I'm really glad that they were looking at just the raw data. So their goal in this was to identify any potential instances or indications of sexual violence. And the UN team conducted confidential interviews with a total of 34 people, including with survivors and witnesses of the October 7th attack, with released hostages, with first responders, health and service providers, and others. So what did they find? What does this report say? Well, the report states, based on the information it gathered, the mission team found clear and convincing information that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, has been committed against hostages and has reasonable grounds to believe that such violence may be ongoing against those still held in captivity. They go on in the report to get even more graphic. They say there are reasonable grounds to believe that conflict-related sexual violence occurred in multiple locations during the 7 October attack, including rape and gang rape in at least 3 locations, namely the Nova Music Festival site and surrounding Road 232, Kibbutz Remen, I believe is how you say that. In most of these incidents, the report says victims first subjected to rape were then killed, and at least 2 instances relate to the rape of women's corpses. The mission team also found a pattern of victims, mostly women, found fully or partially naked, bound, and shot across multiple locations. The report concludes, overall, the mission team is of the view that the true prevalence of sexual violence during the 7 October attack and their aftermath may take months or years to emerge and may never be fully known. So we haven't recently seen a lot of great things out of the UN. It's no secret that they are a pretty biased body. And so I'm really glad to see that they looked at this fully, and not only looked at it, they said, okay, this is what we found, and we think more investigation is needed. They're saying, you know, this was pretty brief. They took about 2 months to do this whole investigation. They only spent 2 weeks over there. And they're saying, okay, we recognize there's more here. We have to dig deeper. We need a larger team. We need more investigation. But when you all saw this study, what were your thoughts? What were your first reactions?
I mean, are we surprised? Was kind of my first thought. Yeah. But also, where is the oversight? Where is the accountability? Great, you made this report. Now, where are the actions? I'm so tired of, especially because we fund a lot of the UN, more than any country. And we're not even tolerating sexual harassment in photos. So, like, where is this crackdown? Where is the action and the accountability here? Those women, just, you got to pray for their souls at this point, because they underwent horrible atrocities. Pray for their families. This is horrible. And I just, my heart rate, I could probably check it right now, is over 100, because it just breaks my heart that this is what's happening. And the UN is like, we need to investigate further. That's what we're going to do next. We're not going to do anything besides investigate it further. I get it. United Nations, you have to, you know, it's a system of a lot of different countries. But yeah, we're footing the bill for a lot of this. So some action needs to be taken because this is absolutely disgusting.
I think it's also an indication, like you said, it's the UN is not exactly an unbiased institution, of how truly horrific it was. Mm-hmm. If the UN is willing to come out with this study and say it was just awful, they weaponized, they used sexual assault as a weapon of war.
Mm-hmm.
And they treated their victims as objects, not as human beings. It's just, it's gut-wrenching. And when you read as to why some of the conclusions they weren't able to verify, it sounds, if you read between the lines, because certain victims were burned so badly that there's not enough evidence to say one way or the other.
Yeah.
And that is just, this is evil.
There's no other word for it.
Exactly. Yeah. We need to confront this. Evil still exists in the world, and this is one very potent example.
Yeah, it is.
It also makes you worried for the people still in Gaza. Like, what is happening? I mean, not just the hostages, but the people that are, you know, have lived there for a while. It's scary.
Yeah.
And you're empowering this group that, I just am speechless.
So there's 19 hostages, female hostages, that we know of who are still in Gaza. 5 of them are their bodies are there. They're no longer alive. 14, we believe, are still alive. That's according to the Times of Israel. And just this week, several leading Israeli women appeared in a video. Actually, the video was released the same day that report was released, saying the names of these 19 women ahead of International Women's Day, which is tomorrow. And the video, it begins with a woman saying, "This year, there are only 19 reasons to celebrate International Women's Day." And then the names of each of these women are spoken. And I think it's just really powerful to hear their names spoken. So let's go ahead and take a listen to that video.
השנה יש רק 19 סיבות לציין את יום האישה הבינלאומי.
נעמה.
ג'ודי.
נועה.
רומי.
כרמל.
ארבל.
Maya,
Eden,
Inbar,
Doron,
Liri,
Daniela.
So almost all of those women whose names were spoken, they're young. They're in their teens, 20s, some are in their 30s. And like you said, Kristen, it's a praying. It's a, okay, Lord, spare their lives. We have no idea the atrocities that they have endured for, it's been like 150 days, I think, that they've been hostage, just over 150 days. So we continue to pray for their freedom, their release. Hostage negotiations are stalled right now. And it's been just such a back and forth of with hostage negotiations and Hamas demanding crazy things and Israel saying, well, obviously, we're not going to do that. So we continue to pray because at this point, that's what we can do. And of course, there's also a level of reminding our leaders and the American people that we stand with Israel.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, stay tuned because up next, we crown our Problematic Woman of the Week. Virginia Allen here. I want to tell you all about a great way you can stay in the know on all the news the Daily Signal covers. Social media. The Daily Signal has an active presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We are constantly posting news stories, clips from interviews, videos, and more across all our social platforms. Follow the Daily Signal on social media so you can get all the latest content from reels on Instagram to video clips on Facebook and political commentary on Twitter.
Now, it is that time once again, my favorite time of the week, time to crown our Problematic Woman of the Week. And the crown goes to
two very special women named Lucy and Hannah. Lucy is the sister and Hannah is the niece of one of the hostages that is still held in Gaza. Keith Sigel is a North Carolina native. And so his sister, Lucy, and his niece, Hannah, are the special guests at State of the Union. They are special guests for Senators Tom Tillis of North Carolina and Ted Budd of North Carolina. And so traditionally, with the State of the Union, every senator, every lawmaker gets to invite one guest. And so these senators have said, all right, as we continue to say in our state, we stand with Israel. And as we continue to call for the release of the hostages with individuals like those 14 women that we just talked about, or so many, there's about 100 men who are believed to still be alive and held hostage, and Keith is one of those men. So we want to honor these, just as these senators are honoring these women, we wanted to honor them here today. For Lucy and Hannah, I just can't imagine, as a family member, to how do you go about finding peace when you know someone that you love so dearly is being held hostage, and you yourself have little to no power to do anything about it. Just incredibly, incredibly challenging. And so I'm glad to see that we have senators who are saying, all right, we're going to keep bringing this to the forefront. We're not going to let this be hidden or forgotten. And that we have individuals like Lucy and Hannah who are continuing to be a voice for their loved ones who are held hostage.
I literally can't imagine. I have a younger sister and a younger brother. So having that, cannot imagine. So full prayers for them. And friendly reminder that the State of the Union is this week. So it's
Thursday night. Tonight.
It's tonight. Yeah.
Thursday night. Yeah. Get the popcorn out.
Gosh, it's going to be late.
It's going to be late night.
Might fall asleep depending on the content.
Yeah. Or the delivery.
Yeah. The Daily Signal will be covering it.
Brenda gets it.
Stay asleep with us. Oh, wow. Well, Brenda, thanks for being with us today. Always enjoy having you on the show.
It was so much fun. Thank
this
you.
Great. Well, with that, that is going to do it for this week's edition of Problematic Women.
Join us next Thursday morning for a brand new edition. And in the meantime, please subscribe and share.
As conservatives, we need your support in the podcast world. So take a minute, leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you like to listen. We're across all podcast platforms. And what that does is it helps spread the word to even more listeners and really helps us in our promotion of the show.
Yeah, spread the good news. Have a great week, guys.
Enjoy So Too.
So Too.
Problematic Women is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation.
It is a product of the Daily Signal produced by Lauren Evans and Virginia Allen. And be sure to follow Problematic Women on Instagram.
We produce Problematic Women in remembrance of our dear friend and former co-host, Bree Payton.